This is a section of the panelists, and Geev Patel, also an old friend. They're all old friends here, which is nice. I think we'll respond and bring back many of the issues that Timothy raised, and you know, present them in our context.
Thank you, Vivan. Actually, I have a short presentation. Perhaps I'll keep my responses to what I've heard so far to later in the day, or maybe even tomorrow, as we gather more material and you know, our discourse can widen in its scope. For the moment, bear with me this very short presentation, which I'm focusing on moments of change in an artist's career, specifically in a painter's career. And for this purpose, I have chosen the works of two painters, a younger person and an older one, Atul Dodia, who is in his 30s, and Tayab Mehta, who is in his 60s. And I will demonstrate a moment in the career of both these artists when a very important transformation occurs in their work. I think that for me, painting as a discipline is very important because, you know, within the limits of that medium, it allows profound transformations of this kind to happen. I'll start with Atul Dodia's work. May we have the lights off, please? This is an early Atul Dodia. You can see that Atul works with photographs. You can see that he has a very fine facility with all the techniques of painting. He can evoke atmosphere and location with great accuracy and feeling. Qualities of light, time of day, all of these are details, you know, sensual reality, with which details which he can convey very well. The second slide is also an early work. Once again, you know, the heat of the day, the stance of the animal, the industrial landscape behind, very much to do with the time in which we live. Dodia continuously expressed dissatisfaction with these earlier works. And I think that there was a very long period of introspection and of trying to push away from the limits of this form of work. And I think that a lot of internal work must have gone in at this point in his career. And then he came upon the painting which I'm going to show you next. And I'll just say a few words about the painting. It's about the artist painting in his studio at night. And Atul said that this place where he paints is a kind of a little place in the suburb where he grew up as a boy. And he's very familiar with the building and the grounds of the building. And one of the things that has remained with him very, very, very strongly is this memory of there having been lots of rats in the compound. And that these rats made lots of tunnels and burrows under the building and in the compound. And as boys, he said, we would smoke them out from one tunnel into another, you know. So had these boyhood kind of cruel games with these rats, which has lingered in his memory. And so he did this painting of himself toiling away, painting away at night in his studio with tunnels of rats under him. May we see the painting? A little focus, please. little more. Yeah. I talked to him at length about the work, and I was surprised that he was not aware of the real subject of this painting, which is, I'm sitting on a bomb, I'm painting on a bomb, because really, it is the underworld of his mind on which he is working. And those are gnawing creatures that are making those tunnels in the subterranean layers of his mind. And for the first time in a young artist's career, something like this has surfaced. And I sensed that it would be a prelude to a number of works which would come up with the conflicts that have now been released. The little rat figures, incidentally, in the tunnel, which can be seen. And there's another little motif, which again recurs in several paintings later, which is the peeling paint on a wall. There are patches you can see on the painting, and these patches don't correspond to objects on the painting, in the painting itself. They don't correspond to a particular wall or a particular tree. The patches, in fact, treat the surface of the painting as though it were a wall. So that, in effect, the very painting is peeling before our eyes. And with the gnawing creatures under his feet and the patches peeling off his skin, so to speak, and which evoke things like skin disease and leprosy, we are into pretty serious business. Next, please. So the release that this painting gave Atul Dodia then led him on to a set of very personal works. This painting is called O Naina, and it talks about the hospitalization of his sister, who went through a very critical illness. And repeatedly had to be hospitalized and had to undergo surgery. And now, you have, again, a painting which has all the aesthetic balances of his earlier work, all the technical facility. It's beautiful to look at, as the earlier works were, but now it's talking about something else. It is talking about pain, and it is talking about death, and things of in that region of experience. Also very interesting to see the two coconuts in the center of the painting, which would be used for the nutrition of the patient, and a skull behind the two coconuts, which closely simulates the coconuts themselves. And the surgical instruments, they really look like they mean business. Aside from the gnawing, which the earlier painting talked about, we now have chiseling and hammering and things like that. The next one. At the same time, the painting does convey a sense of tenderness as well towards a sister who's undergoing the suffering. The beautiful little pillow and a rakhi there. I'm showing you this painting again to show you the leprous patches of peeling wall, which rather impartially covers the Gandhi figure or the politician or the five-star hotel in the background. And so seems to be something that is affecting the entire society, and not just any one detail in it. Next painting, please. A little focus, please. This is an old photograph of people who have gathered to mourn Mahatma Gandhi's death. It's in an old album, and the entire painting itself simulates the album and the turn page of the album. And again, you have the peeling patches of wall. And in this case, you have additionally insects that have gnawed into the old album and into the photograph, and that have been burrowing all over. There's no need to elaborate further on the symbolism of the work. These are the sets of new works that were occasioned by that one acknowledgement of the bomb under the artist's feet. I will now move to Tayyab Mehta and show you how in an artist in a later part of his career, similar extraordinary transformations can happen. Tayyab Mehta, one part of Tayyab Mehta's work is concerned with personal anxiety and anguish and existential terror. And both of these are embodied in two or three images, and he works repeatedly on those images. These images are the images of the trussed bull, of the rickshaw puller, and of the human figure falling head first down into bottomless space. And through his career, he has worked on these three images in different ways. Now, this is an early trussed bull. Next, please. And this is a falling figure, again, an early work. You can see there's a lot of expressionist brushwork in this painting, but as he goes on, the brushwork becomes more and more restrained, and the painting is cleaned out into surfaces. It becomes a kind of a wish to rule out hysteria and to control the emotion without losing any of its intensity. And so you have two more falling figures, which I'll show you after this. In the next two paintings, there's also the introduction of a motif which Tayyab Mehta worked on for a whole decade or more, which is the motif of the diagonal, which cuts across the painting from upper right to lower left. And so gives you, divides the painting into two, creates a schism, and the painter's task is then to reassemble the painting across the schism. May we have the next one, please? You can see the cleaned out color, the diagonal, and the continuation of the theme of the falling figure. Little focus, please. Sorry, I think you need more focus. No, is that it? Yeah. Now, sometime in the 80s, Tayyab Mehta stayed for a long time in Bengal, and he was very moved and very strongly affected by the image of Kali. And I think the next few years went really in digesting this image and trying to make something of it. And he then came up with two or three paintings of the figure of Kali, which I think are of historical importance to contemporary Indian painting, because for the first time, a traditional image of a deity has been worked out by a contemporary Indian artist in terms of a what one might call a modern classicism, so that the work becomes a kind of a counterpoint to centuries of classical deity images that we have been that we know of in our civilization. Other painters have worked with deity images, but none of them has tried to obtain for us, for our contemporary moment, that classical purity of utterance. It is also an important moment because this is a transition for Tayyab Mehta from a moment of from working with private anxiety and terror and stepping into a public domain, giving us an icon which is shared by this whole country. Maybe, please. Yeah, thank you. A little more, please. A little focus. Yeah. She's got a skull in her right hand, and there are all the various attributes of Kali, except that there's no necklace of skulls, and surprisingly, there's no sword. You know, which is something that you cannot think of Kali without her sword. And I sort of was rather intrigued by this until it suddenly dawned on me that Mehta had been using Kali's sword, so to speak, for over a whole decade before this painting. That schism which cuts the painting into two is a slash from Kali's sword. And he has now come to a point where he does not need to labor that image any further. And, so the sword is entirely internalized. The image does not need it anymore. Kali's tongue, which is always shown dripping blood, in these two paintings is again quite extraordinarily portrayed. One feels almost as though she were devouring her own tongue, or as though the very contents of her pharynx were being extruded. These are the two examples I wanted to put before you. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yes. Could you develop a bit the relevance of that, of what you're saying, to the to the questions outlined by Prashant in his summary?
Painting and postmodernism. I don't know, Tim, if I have very much to say on the subject, except that it seems to me that if a painter can do this, he's doing a lot, and he may feel, that it's perfectly comfortable for him to carry on working as he is working, which does not, invalidate anybody else wishing to do anything else, either. Family resemblances are something that we live with, Tim,
In fact, I would nominate Atwood as your first postmodern artist.
I'm sorry,
Atul? First postmodern painter, sorry.
First postmodern painter, Atul. Okay. Atul, were these paintings done after your visit to France?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, let me tell you that the discontent that he expressed about the earlier work, lovely though it is, predated his visit to France. well, Tim is trying to push his visit to France that impelled him, that propelled him to do his postmodern work. I have a hunch he'd have come to it anyway. Thank you very much.
Pushpamala also is familiar to most people here, but to those that are not, she's a sculptor and studied in Baroda, did figurative work mainly in terracotta, but has changed her nature of working and is very much engaged with questions of object and material, and I think she's going to bring a very different point of view.
I just have a few observations about the earlier speakers. I found all the three speakers that the speakers gave a very formalist presentation, working within art history. It seemed as if every movement in art or within an artist's work came from art history or from past art or art happening around them. There's no mention of the world outside, even though I expected something else from Vivan's work, because when he told me about his talk, I thought he would really connect up with what actually impelled him to use certain forms or certain materials, or actually coming from the narrative painting tradition, why did he break away? Why did he feel the need to break away? It's not just using, different materials or just extending your practice or something. There has to be a need to extend, to change. Another thing I'd like to say about Timothy's talk is that painting is booming in India. And I think one of the reasons why several thinking artists are really reconsidering their practice or breaking away from their past work, and they've been successful artists, is that it was really in the 80s that painting became a commodity in India. And I think till then, Indian artists were quite sort of modern, modest sort of individuals, quietly working away and being sort of engaged in nation building in a sense, talking about issues to do with building up a history of contemporary Indian art. And then suddenly in the 80s, for a lot of reasons like liberalization perhaps, and certain things like the India festivals, then there was this boom, the middle classes started suddenly looking at history of contemporary Indian art. And there were these auctions with the Sotheby's and Christie's. And of course, the oil painting really came into its own. And there's supposed to be classical, modernist Indian oil painting and so on and so forth. But it was really, that's when painters really started selling work, and prices really shot up. And I think probably till then, painters were not, or artists were not really able to live on their work. And artists are really, I think, pretty prosperous now. Can live on their work by artists. I mean painters. And I think in the first session, I'm the only one who's doesn't come from a painting background. So I've always felt marginal, shall we say. And maybe my presentation is something about that. About Vivan's presentation, I was quite interested when he used the image of this artist at the center of things, with a tremendous amount of mobility, going back and forth in history, using all sorts of materials, having access to all sorts of technologies, using references and quotations from art from all over the world and so on. And I just want to question that mobility. I don't think all of us feel that mobile. I think, recently, many of us are thinking about marginalities and trying in our practice to talk about those marginalities. And all the work you've seen so far has been of male artists, and so let me present two women artists who I'm very close to, and perhaps I can talk about some of these things I've talked about through their I've got a few slides, their work. The first one is Sheila Gowda, who's in her late 30s and who's been a very successful oil painter, and who used to paint in narrative figurative paintings, and has for some time been working in different kinds of her work has changed, and she has been using she did a lot of work in cow dung, And this is from her earlier show, in which they're quite close to her, well, not really formally, but they are more like paintings, more or less flat or relief-like surfaces. And in terms of why her work changed, I remember she'd been talking a lot about using common materials, poor materials, and indigenous materials. And I remember she kept telling me, why don't you sculptors use, you know, materials like cow dung? So we always told her, why don't you use cow dung, you know? But I think what really brought it, you know, I think it was this kind of heightened sort of communal situation in the 80s, and this, you know, the fundamentalist idea, growing fundamentalist ideas, and the kind of misuse or a kind of a certain sort of use of tradition and the traditional, and of in every way, you know, in ritual, in practice, I mean, in terms of Indian culture, in so many ways. So actually, in the series of work, she uses traditional ritual materials, where, like cow dung, kumkum, haldi, rangoli, and you know, so, and, materials like that, with maybe some drawing, as in this painting. As in this work, where at the corner there's a drawing of women working in the fields. I think a man and a woman, people working in the fields, harvesting. And the whole thing is like a ridged, furrowed sort of field. And they're, it's not a very good slide, but this it's quite sort of deep, high relief with the cow dung sort of cakes sort of sticking out. And but she critiques these ritual materials. By actually, she connects them with, because they're also used in daily practice, especially by women, because all these materials are used every day as a part of daily life in large parts of India, rural as well as in urban areas. Next, please. This is a cow dung wash painting. It's a sort of Ardhanarishwar figure, I think. With the breast, she's used a lot of images of the body, the field, the plowed field, and the yoni, images like that. Bits of calico, cheap calico cloth like wounds. Next, please. Focus. These are a series of slides about a work she did in Delhi. It was during the Max Miller had an international artist camp in Delhi in the Buddha Jayanti Park. And I think she somehow managed to find a part of the park which was not manicured, and which she used for a concept of the sacred grove. Now everything is made by hand. There is a well of cow dung bricks in the center with a little depression underneath. And there are certain impressions of her body and like drawings on those bricks. She worked for a month making those bricks by hand. And at the bottom of the trees, there are these cow dung paths, like with drawings, impressions of her body, a bit of gold leaf stuck on them, scattered about. And sometimes a certain individual features of the trees are also outlined in like a particular kind of knot or twist in gold leaf. Next slide, please. This is an imprint of a foot on one of the bricks of the well. Next, please. This is a detail of one of the cow dung paths. At the bottom of one of the trees, with the gold and the drawing. Next, please. Oh, it's the other way around. It's a vertical slide. Never mind. Anyway, earlier slide. Something about the image of the well used over here, though she calls it Sacred Grove, I see a definite relationship between the paintings that she did some years ago when she lived for about 3 or 4 years in a village called Ilwal, near the art college in Mysore where we were both teaching. And she did a series, the paintings she did over there, like most of them were concerned, they had images of wells, women going to the wells to draw water and because there was a terrible sort of water problem in that village, so women had to trudge for miles to for a long distance to collect water. So it's very interesting that she's used this image of the well again as a sort of, and she calls it the Sacred Grove. But it's very much to do with daily life, living and practice, and not really something mystical and folklorish, really. Next, please. I'm showing you now some slides of another friend and colleague, Rumana Hussain's work. She's in her early 40s. And the first few images are from her earlier show. What was it called, Rumana, the show? Called Fragments Multiples. Rumana is a Muslim but an atheist and a thinking sort of artist who has been reflecting about certain things happening in the country and in terms of her own practice and living. And this, she again has been an oil painter. And I think with this show, she broke away to use certain kinds of forms. Her earlier oil paintings too dealt very directly, almost social realist sort of paintings with dealing very directly with certain, like, you know, issues and so on. But with these, she uses different kinds of materials. Again, certain combination of certain traditional materials as well as materials to do with the modern technology. And there, this image of the Babri Masjid dome is referred to in the image of the halved pot. And she uses in the series, she uses the xeroxes of the dome, and the pot is also the womb, and there's images of the broken pot, reflections of the pot. Next, please. The halved pot with geru on a mirrored surface, a yoni-like form. And she's connecting the body, the apertures of the body with violation of the architecture or the monument with violation of the body. And next, please. Well, there were many images. I'm sorry, I'm just showing you these pots, but I'm trying to connect them up with her, the next three slides of her recent work. Sorry, keep it on. This is again a burnt and halved pot with the gheru, or earth, red earth, flowing out of it. Yeah, next please. Well, this is very recent work, which she hasn't shown yet, and she's going to show in April in an exhibition called, it's going to be an installation called Home Bar Nation. And this is from a series of plastic files, which will be hung on a rod, which are called notations. And I thought I wouldn't have very much time, so I didn't show a work which he did in between, which was a performance piece called Living on the Margins. The images of it connect up the earlier work and this. I'll just tell you a little bit about that, where again she used the body and architecture. Well, she did it in the NCPA complex. I think that's the only space she could find. It is a square sort of courtyard with a cement walk bordering a grass a lawn. And she used materials like washing blue, gheru, spilt, and boiling pressure cookers with very smelly substances with them, you know, using smell, sound, which would whistle every now and then. There were artificial paper flowers in a bed on the lawn, on the real lawn. And she had this sort of very ritualistic walk where she carried a halved papaya in her hand. and took a deep breath where the shape of the mouth and the papaya would correspond. And I mean, it's various things happened. There was a vacuum cleaner, and then clothes were washed, which she asked the spectators to come and wash the clothes and so on. Again, she's sort of... why I'm saying this, that these artists, these two artists, are intensely sort of carrying through certain ideas, you know. They're not separate projects, which are... each body of a work presented is not a separate, completely separate project. They're going in a path which is intensive and exploring further and further along certain lines. And here again in Home Nation, she talks about the body, the home, the outside, the monument, and political and other social issues. And she also went back to went on a trip to Ayodhya, Faizabad, and Lucknow to take photographs and collect material, books, poems, and objects, which is used in this work. There are photographs also of the of her maidservant making chapatis repetitively, and repetitive photographs, which are used with the photographs of Mughal monuments, the apertures and the kind of arches of the corresponding with the forms in the you know daily sort of chores of you know corresponding to daily chores. Well, this particular work has a lock of her own hair with a ribbon, and the quotation it says, "Brides and women who took pride in their appearance used to plait their hair at the back from top to the waist, around thick swaths of colored fabric, etc." Which is about the hairstyles of the women of Awadh from Sharar's book. Sharar was an early 20th century historian and novelist who lived in Lucknow. And his book describes the culture and way of life of the people of Lucknow during the 18th and 19th centuries. And there's also this this thing about the Ganga Jamuni culture, which was a mixture of Hindu and Muslim sort of elements, which apparently went on through from a high art kind of you know situation to a low art street situation. Next, please. Then this file has a photo of a papaya, probably from the performance itself. And the text has is about the Narmada Dam and the displacement of the tribal women, with the photographs of with the two amulets, one with an Arabic prayer and one with a picture of Durga. Next, please. File with photograph. This file has a photograph of two women. She doesn't know whether they're sweepers. But anyway, they're standing at the doorway of a house in Faizabad, which is near Ayodhya. And it has also has two needles with threads, with strings. And an Urdu poem is xeroxed on the cover of the file. The Urdu poem is by the Pakistani woman poet Kishwar Naheed. And it's called "Hum Gunegar Aurate," We Sinful Women. I don't know about the contents of the poem, but this is the end of my presentation.
Me, just very briefly answer. I possibly would agree with you that maybe I shouldn't make so many art historical references, and that maybe one should speak more specifically about the forms themselves. But I thought that the contextualizing and the reason why something came into being in terms of the social and political references were always stated, and in fact quite forthrightly stated in every body of work. So even the work which is Houseboat, it seems quite minimalist. I always bring up the references to any visual input, and it was quite clear that maybe I was even politicizing a cube. And also my clear affiliations and activity with Samoth, so that I'm not seeing them as separate parts. Well, if there is a criticism about the scale of operations and movement across, and that if this is some privilege that men have, well, I don't quite know how to answer that, but I wouldn't like to believe that women only work in modest and marginal scales. And I'll refer you to a well-known American woman artist called Anne Hamilton, who I happen to have heard her talk in Montreal. She comes from sort of low middle class, working class background. In fact, she happened to be a seamstress in Montreal. The scale of her installations would make my Darbar Hall presentation look almost like a miniature. That I just couldn't believe one after the other in a relatively short period of less than a decade. She had done such spectacular work. It's not for me to describe it, but just to state that she could take on so much scale. And I, in fact, maybe like you, I got disturbed in a different way, and I said, well, maybe only an American could do it. I didn't say maybe.
Well, I didn't say that.
Just finally, then okay. You can answer. Just a small thing about, mm-hmm. I think, yes, painting is very much alive and very dynamic and very active in India, and that by an interesting sort of difference, what Timothy said, that by a certain period, the end of the 80s, there was a recession and the art market started collapsing. Well, actually, it's not the 80s that there has been the art boom in India and the boom for painting. It actually, the date is March 89 when it began. And it's these last 7 years where we have seen the phenomenal rise of painting, both in terms of the market as well as the quantity produced. Any questions?
Well, I'd like to clarify that. I didn't say that only men, the works I was presenting seem so, you know, opposite to what you were saying in some way, not opposite, but, well, modest in that sense that I contextualize them. But I didn't say that no woman would do, you know, large scale work or anything of the sort.
Well, just a small point, okay. I agree that sculpture, because I faced it myself or facing it, that yes, sculpture is marginalized, or it has hardly any market vis-a-vis painting. I mean that is more than clear. So on that part, I'm very much with you. But I would just like to add that there is a greater mobility, and people are moving, and people are showing. And I mean, for example, Sheila Gowda showed in Johannesburg, is going to New York. In fact, she's facing a problem about her not being able to import cow dung to New York. She managed somehow to get it into South Africa, but she's not going to be able to take her work there.
That's not the only problem, actually. She's not allowed to make cow dung. She can use American cow dung, but Apinan doesn't want her to make bricks, which he would rather make. He wants her to make Indian-looking cow dung pats. Actually, that's the problem.
Yeah, Lali.
Maybe I misunderstood. Yeah. I thought Pushpa Mala was disappointed that Vivan hadn't repudiated painting more strongly. That's what I thought.
No, I think he was not clear about why he started doing something else, you know. It's not some, I mean, if you just talk in a formal way that I wanted to use this material and that material, I mean, that's very obvious. You are using it, so you obviously you wanted to use it, you know. But what is the impulsion, external and internal and so on? Because you see, when I talked to him, I got very nervous about this. I mean, I rang him up and said, what are you talking about, you know, because I'm in your session. And he said, I'm going to talk about this art project and about the internal and, you know, what makes me, I mean, like, you know, why I work in projects and what makes me do them and internal as well as external reasons, you know, and those, they are there in his work, you know. I mean, like say the Amrita Shergill project, for instance, I mean, he's been obsessed with Amrita, figure of Amrita Shergill for like more than 20 years. It's to do with his own autobiography, it's to do with his family, as well as like she was a major Indian artist, and she was half Hungarian, half Indian, and all the problems and issues that come up with that, you know. That's very interesting, you know, one wants to know that. I mean, if you say this box came from somewhere and the images come from some other, you know, style of art or something like that, I mean, that's obvious. For me, that's obvious rather than the, but you know, why.
Mean, in fact, I went and slightly and unfairly to the audience described a work called Self-Portrait and Portrait of Daughter, that is of Umrao Singh and his daughter, precisely because I was speaking very much about a relationship of father to daughter, and my looking at the relationship then of my grandfather and my aunt. And so I think that I very much foregrounded something personal and autobiographical, not at all in formalist terms, but, you know, suggesting relationship, desire, etc. So, yes, Laleen had a question.
From an Australian cultural perspective, as a feminist, the rhetoric of your argument is familiar, but what is perhaps not familiar to you is my cultural context has fetishized and commodified the notion of marginality. Now, I'm not suggesting that you are speaking from that position. I absolutely understand that you're in a different cultural context, and marginality might mean something very different in India. But what is more familiar to me in your rhetoric as a feminist is a feminist sort of international rhetoric. Now, this is not simply regional, but it is a feminist international rhetoric about women's marginality. Now, we know that that's true, but we also know that there's a point at which it has become a cliche and you have to stop saying that. And part of the rhetoric of that is that there's a polarization between formalism, art history, formidable genealogies on the one hand, and valorization of the everyday. Now, yeah, I think that leads to an impasse where feminism is going to look at the everyday, the nitty-gritty, the devalorized, throwaway material. Why create this problem for yourself? When the history of modern art is an enormously rich source, and why use formalism as a bad word?
No, not at all. I'm showing you my work. I'm very interested in formalism.
Yeah, no, but your critique is
I'm sorry. What happens in this kind of 15-minute presentation is that I can show very few slides. I'm not even being fair to these artists.
Yes.
And even when I choose certain artists, it doesn't mean that I completely agree with all the things that they're trying to say or they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it becomes very difficult to say. I would actually like to present several artists because people are working in so many different ways with monumental, you know, size, with different technological media, with different kinds of formal means. And so on, you know. But I was supposed to be a discussant and a respondent. It's very difficult, you know. It's a little difficult to. No, even with these people's work, there is actually a if I show, if I talked about the stress the everyday, it's because they're dealing with certain, I think, subjects or issues which are, you know. Talking about, like, you know, tradition in a certain way or culture in a certain way. Or you know, in very sort of large, monumental, and epic ways, like, you know, and it's a kind of juxtaposition always that they're dealing with, you know. It's not that it's one thing; it's the only the everyday. It's just they're using certain materials not to do. I mean, with also to do with other things.
Yeah, my point is, artists may be doing that, but I'm talking about the rhetoric of your.
Oh, my, sorry. I mean, I didn't know it came out that way. I agree with you completely. Actually, I didn't mean it to come out that way. Yeah.
Feminist. yeah. to make that polarization.
Okay. No, I didn't realize there was polarization made, actually.
But,
yeah.
You know, there is, on the one hand, there is the international rhetoric, but there is something specific as well. I mean, the specific situation is...
Yeah, but I'm hearing the international rhetoric, and that's the only way I can define it as a foreigner.
But the specific situation, I mean, the situation of women in India
yes.
is might require a woman artist to sort of emphasize certain things and to speak out.
Indeed, it would,
right. So,
most certainly.
You know, and to very specifically sure. say where, you know, this, I mean, for instance, there have, before Pushpa spoke, the slides that were shown were of certain male artists, and there was a certain rhetoric that existed here that, you know, before, you know, women were absolutely sort of, there was a certain rhetoric, and it's now being sort of negated in a sense. And so therefore, certain things have to be specified very clearly, which you may not on a platform, say, if you're talking in America or in England or whatever, you may not have to.
No, or in another context as well, and I'm just talking, you know, in a more detailed way or... Anyway, I agree with you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to come out in such, you know, stereotypical way or something.
Just one more question and then we wait for that.
It's taking off from what you had said earlier also about appropriation and marginalization. And considering, for instance, that you took Hoshi Jal's work and then you're exhibiting it, and then Hoshi Jal takes a photograph of it, which then appears on the first page of the largest English newspaper in India. Perhaps we shouldn't be talking about appropriation and marginalization, but about hegemony and I scratch your back, you scratch my
back. That's nasty, Girish.
Yes, if you want to call it that kind of nepotism, I have no answer.
One only little thing is that he played safe, he didn't put his own photograph into the photograph. Okay, thank you very much.